Hello and welcome to NewsHour Live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. On the opening day of the COP29 Climate Change Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan, a stark warning, a red alert issued by the UN's World Meteorological Organization. 2024 is on track to be the hottest year on record, and the Earth's surface temperature has breached the 1.5 degree rise on pre-industrial levels that climate scientists warn will lead to more extreme weather events. Now, that could be temporary and may have been influenced by the El Niño effect this year, but the message is we're already at a critical moment. We'll hear from the World Meteorological Organization in a moment. First, the current COP president, Mukhtar Babayev, opened the proceedings today and he said there was a difficult task ahead for the delegates.
COP29 is a moment of truth for the Paris Agreement. It will test our commitment to the multilateral climate system. We must now demonstrate that we are prepared to meet the goals we have set ourselves. This is not easy.
But how far is the event being influenced by the prospect of a new Trump administration in the White House? Mr. Trump is a known climate change skeptic and pulled the USA out of the Paris Agreement last time he was in office. John Podesta, a senior advisor to the current US President Joe Biden for international climate policy, also spoke at the summit not long ago.
What I want to tell you today is that while the United States federal government under Donald Trump may put climate action on the back burner, the work to contain climate change is going to continue in the United States with commitment and passion and belief.
Well, we're joined live now by Matt McGrath, our environment correspondent. He's in Baku. Matt, what is on the agenda this time around? What are the big aims?
Well, Rebecca, the big issue here, as you've been hearing from those clips, apart from Donald Trump, is the question of finance, of cash, essentially, to help developing countries to fight the impacts of climate change and to help them transition away from the causes of climate change, the use of fossil fuels. Now, there's been a long-standing agreement that the richer countries would help the poorer countries. They've been supposed to give them $100 billion a year since 2020. They got to that figure a couple of years late. Now they have to agree a new one, and the developing countries are saying, well, the answer has to now be in the trillions rather than the billions, and the richer countries are balking at that prospect. So that's the big central question here. It's really wrapped up in this question of if the richer countries are prepared to give more money, then the poorer countries, developing countries, are prepared and able to do more to cut their carbon. So it's like there's a balance and a trade-off to be arrived at there, but they're nowhere near that yet.
And you mentioned there the fact that a new administration is coming into the White House. How is that shaping discussions there?
Now, a lot of people have been here before. In 2016, when President Trump was elected for the first time, the COP was being held in Marrakesh, and a lot of people who were at that event 8 years ago are still here involved. So I think there's a question of disappointment amongst many people here, but also a sense that they survived the last time, perhaps they can survive this time as well, and that others will kind of step up and take the place. But I think others actually feel that things could be much worse this time, and that if President Trump might have learned some lessons from his last attempt and may actually be able to go further in removing climate protections than he was the last time.
All right, for the moment, thank you very much indeed. That's Matt McGrath there, our environment correspondent. He's in Baku at the moment. Well, let's see if we can break down some of those stats coming from the World Meteorological Organization, because they do sound pretty alarming. What are the details and what do they tell us? Is there anything encouraging in these results? Let's speak live now to Co Barrett. She's the Deputy Secretary General of the WMO. Welcome to the programme. Thanks so much for making time for us. First, let's address this rise in the surface temperature this year, breaching the 1.5 degrees. We are on record to be the hottest year ever. How much of that is down to the El Niño effect, if anything?
Yes. Hi, Rebecca, and thanks for having us. As you say, obviously 2024 is on track to be the warmest year ever, surpassing even 2023, which smashed records. And you're right, in 2024 and in 2023, we did have an El Niño effect. But what we are really seeing here is a temperature anomaly on top of a very steady long-term trend from background climate change.
And just remind us why this figure of 1.5 degree rise, this is in the surface temperature of the Earth, why is that considered the threshold?
Well, I mean, the Paris Agreement has set 1.5 degrees as a policy goal to set climate action targets against. So that is very much in the thinking of decision makers. But of course, you know, we measure 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial temperatures by looking at that level across decades, not just one calendar year as we now have.
Yeah, but in terms of what it means for those of us living on Earth and the environment and other animals, what is the danger if we go above that substantially?
Yeah, I mean, the IPCC, which is the world's kind of esteemed climate science body, has determined that 1.5 degrees is a threshold to determine, you know, levels by which we can kind of forestall the worst climate impacts. And every fraction of a degree of warming that goes above that really matters in terms of extinctions and the kinds of impacts that humans and ecosystems will face.
So given then that we're in the hottest decade ever and this year that 1.5 degree rise has been breached, have we already failed to achieve, you know, keeping to under the threshold? Or is there a chance that we could still achieve that now?
There is a chance that we can still achieve that. I don't think we can declare failure at this point, but the trend is not good. As I said, you really need to measure these temperatures across decades, not just for a given year. But the trend is pretty significant. And as you pointed out, the period from 2015 to 2024 will be the warmest 10 years on record, regardless of whether an El Nino is in effect or not. So this is a cause for alarm.
Yeah, and we've already seen the effects, haven't we, of climate change. This year alone, we've seen these devastating hurricanes, not least in the United States, two within days of each other last month, both growing very fast. How are ocean temperatures and ice loss also impacting things?
Yeah, well, ocean temperatures really provide a kind of, they play a role in providing fuel for the rapidly intensifying hurricanes. So that's a key concern. And I'll say I have a home in North Carolina in the U.S. and was directly impacted by those two hurricanes coming days apart. So, but it's not just in the U.S. I mean, we're seeing an incredible volume of rain in the Sahel, in Brazil, in Spain. Which is really a wake-up call about how much more water a warmer atmosphere can hold and how difficult it is to prepare for events that are entirely outside our previous experience.
Mm. All right. Well, for the moment, thanks very much for joining us live. That's Co Barrett there, Deputy Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization. Let's get the perspective of a former COP president now, because we're joined by Lord Alok Sharma. He's a British Conservative politician who hosted the COP26 summit. That was the delayed one in Glasgow, Scotland in 2021. And he also joins us live from Baku. Lord Sharma, thank you very much for coming on the programme. What is your feeling about this particular COP summit? Because we often see that there are agreements made at these summits. They sound pretty good. But how often are signatories to these agreements effectively held to account to keep the promises they make?
Rebecca, thank you for having me on. I mean, I think you make an incredibly important point, which is that to get commitments out of countries is, of course, challenging. But the key here is to get them to actually deliver on those commitments and show that they're actually making progress. I mean, we've just heard that, you know, 1.5 degree target is very much on life support. And in fact, it's been there for a number of years. And that window to keep it alive is very much closing unless governments are prepared to act with much more urgency. So in terms of this COP, obviously, delivery of a new finance goal is going to be key. Hopefully, some countries will come forward with new emission reduction targets for 2035. But also, I think critically, what we need to see is for countries to explain what progress they have made on their previous commitments. And one of the key commitments that was made last year was for countries to transition away from fossil fuels in energy systems. And energy systems, you know, the energy sector effectively responsible for 75% of global emissions. I think the world wants to know what every country is actually doing with regard to this commitment.
So, I mean, how effective are the mechanisms, though, to hold countries to account and produce delivery, as you say yourself there? I mean, we've had several countries rowing back on promises that they've made, not least the United States, in fact. And, you know, we know that Donald Trump backed out of the Paris Climate Agreement, which so much of this hinges on, doesn't it? There's Joe Biden reversed that decision, but Mr. Trump is coming back, and one of the things he's been saying recently is he wants to drill and go back to more fossil fuels.
Yes, I mean, look, I think in terms of countries being held to account, I think the fact that they make these commitments allows their public, you know, at every COP, it is incredibly important because the biggest emitters sit across the table with the largest emitters and are able to look them in the eye and ask them to do more. And if they're not doing more, ask them why they're not doing more. So I think having these COPs is vital for that. Now, in relation to the US, as you said, you know, Mr. Trump is now going to be back as president for a second term. We don't yet know exactly what he will do. But, you know, if he does walk away from the Paris Agreement, if he does walk away from climate action, that obviously is going to have a negative impact. It's already casting a shadow on these negotiations here.
It's very difficult, though, isn't it? And people, you know, organisers do end up getting themselves into compromising positions, which you do also know about from your experience in COP22, when the wording of the text was changed very late in the day from a commitment to phase out fossil fuels, coal in particular, I think, and that was changed instead to the slightly weaker phase down, and that was in you know, to get the deal over the line. We're sort of running out of time for these sort of compromises now, aren't we?
We are. And I think, you know, and of course, you're absolutely right. At COP26, we did go from phase out to phase down. But the other remarkable aspect of it was that it took us 26 COPs to even get to a discussion on fossil fuels and on coal. And I was being told by countries and others right up until that last morning of the negotiations is that, you know, the UK's had a good go, but you won't be able to get any language on coal. And yet 2 years later, we've now got language on transitioning away from fossil fuels. So I think these negotiations are incredibly frustrating. Anyone who's been involved will tell you. And yes, it is compromise. You're trying to get 200 countries to agree to something. But what they have shown over the years is that they do move things forward.
Okay.
I think the real issue is that we're not moving fast enough in terms of tackling climate change.
Okay, it's very good to get you on the programme. Thank you so much for coming on. That's Lord Alok Sharma there speaking to us live. Now coming up, Squid Game might be one of the most successful TV series of all time, but it hasn't actually made its creator wealthy.
Even though the first series was such a huge global success, honestly, I didn't make much. So doing the second series will help compensate me for the success of the first one, too.
More on the money issues of Squid Game, amongst other things, coming up later. Our headlines this hour, as we've been hearing, the COP29 climate summit opening in Azerbaijan has been warned that this year is likely to be the hottest ever on record. And in a landmark ruling, a court in India has stated that a woman going into a hotel room with a man does not imply her consent to sexual intercourse. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, could an emergency summit between two formerly sworn enemies shift the situation in southern Lebanon and Gaza towards peace? Delegates meeting in the Saudi capital Riyadh include senior Iranian officials as well as Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. Saudi Arabia and Iran have been fierce rivals for influence in the Middle East, but formally ended hostilities last year. Delegates at the summit are calling for an immediate end to Israel's military action against the Iran-backed militant groups Hamas and Hezbollah. Saudi leader Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman delivered that message in his opening speech.
We call upon the international community to fulfill its responsibilities in maintaining international peace and security by immediately stopping Israeli attacks on our brothers in Palestine and Lebanon, obliging Israel to respect the sovereignty of the brotherly Islamic Republic of Iran and refrain from attacking its territories.
Saudi leader focusing on Israel there, but is the re-election of Donald Trump to the White House also influencing these talks? Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Ismail Baghouri said from Tehran earlier today that they'd be watching the US actions closely.
Future American statesmen should learn from this situation and stick to the promises they made during the election campaign. The region, the Muslim world, and every country in the world are keeping a close eye on the behaviour of the American government, whether it's the previous administration or the next one.
Well, Muhammad Ali Shabani is the editor of Amwaj.media. It's a London-based news site focusing on Iran, Iraq, the Arabian Peninsula. So what is the significance of this summit, and can it make a difference in Lebanon and Gaza?
I think the number one factor to look at, specifically reference to Gaza, is the U.S. position. And under Biden, we saw a almost 500% increase in weapons sales to Israel, or weapons transfers. And in that respect, we may see a shift with the coming into office of Trump. So I believe that the positions of regional countries are secondary. Even if, let's say, Iran and Saudi Arabia were to be on the same side and very strongly push for a ceasefire and even be joined by Arab countries which have normalized relations with Israel, such as the UAE, and even if Turkey were to join and they take practical measures, such as imposition of a blockade or a boycott, which Iran has called for almost a year now, which hasn't materialized, that still is unlikely to end the war.
And so how will each side be viewing this new Trump administration coming in January?
Well, I think Saudi Arabia is comfortable with Trump. In his first term, they enjoyed very strong relations. However, I think the kingdom is a very different country today than it was 4 years ago, 5 years ago. It has different relations in the region. Last year, it normalized ties with Iran. It's trying to hedge in many ways, also by building relations with Russia, building relations with China. So we're looking at a very different region than it was 5 years ago. But having said that, I think Saudi Arabia is quite comfortable with Trump. Iran, on the other hand, well, has a very difficult past with Trump. It's not just that he is likely to come in swinging more sanctions. It's also that he was the person who authorized the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, a senior Iranian commander in Iraq, which almost brought the two countries to the brink of war back in 2020.
Well, you talk about their various relations with the United States. What about their relations with each other? I mean, you've mentioned there that they've normalized relations, but they've been sworn enemies for many years, haven't they? And yet, yesterday we saw that the Saudi military chief also traveled to Tehran. This, I think, was to talk about deeper defense cooperation between the two. And it's happening as this summit is taking place in Riyadh.
They are still very, very early on, I would say, in their normalization. On the economic front, the dividends that Iran foresaw were anticipated haven't materialized. So when we look at things like the visit by the defense chief of staff, you have to look at the practical outcomes, what's really coming out of it. So I don't really see defense cooperation coming out of it. It could be that this could be a consolation prize, for instance, for Saudi Arabia pushing back joint military exercises. On the other hand, it could pave the way for it with Saudi Arabia signaling to Iran that we want to do more, but we have to wait and see what happens with Trump.
Muhammad Ali Shabani, the editor of Amwaj.media. On to television news now, and it's a huge industry, so not as much of a frivolous story as you may think. Squid Game, the dystopian South Korean TV series, took the world by storm about 3 years ago, becoming the biggest hit ever for Netflix. The show struck a chord with audiences everywhere with its dark take on inequality, and it put Korean dramas, or K-dramas, in the global spotlight. But just as fans are awaiting the release of Series 2, Korea's film and TV producers say their industry is facing a serious cash flow crisis. Our Seoul correspondent Jean McKenzie visited the set to find out what's at stake.
What is that? We're just walking now into the dormitory set, so the set with all the beds where the contestants sleep at night.
Squid Game is a dystopian thriller where hundreds of fictional contestants, deep in debt, fight it out to win a huge cash prize by playing a series of children's games. Only the winner gets to survive. But it's not just the contestants that have suffered in the making. So has its creator, director Hwang Dong-hyuk.
I read that you were so stressed during the first series that you lost six teeth. Is that true?
Eight or nine teeth.
Mm-hmm. Wow. The first series was a social commentary about inequality in Korea. Is there going to be a new theme in the second series?
We've seen recently that conflicts in Korea and elsewhere don't just end with the rich and poor. They're playing out between different generations, genders, and political camps. We're entering an era of us versus them.
Now, at the end of every round, the contestants must pick a side. Do they want to end the game and survive, or keep playing? Majority rules. I'm told this will lead to more fights, more drama. But it's also to prove director Hwang's point that forcing people to pick sides fuels conflict.
You didn't want to do a second series.
Yes.
You were adamant. So why did you change your mind?
Money.
Even though the first series was such a huge global success, honestly, I didn't make much. So doing the second series will help compensate me for the success of the first one, too.
Hwang was only paid an upfront fee, meaning he couldn't cash in on the show's enormous success. This is a problem across the industry. Netflix and other streaming platforms have pumped loads of money into Korea. They bought it worldwide recognition. But because of how they operate, the creators say they've been left with little to show for it. Here in Seoul, writers, directors and actors have gathered determined to fight the current system. Korean content is facing a serious crisis, they declare. They want the government to change the law, to force streaming platforms to share out their profits. The new series of Squid Game, which is out over Christmas, will surely give the industry another boost. But as for director Hwang's teeth, when I caught up with him after filming, it didn't look so good.
I think I still got the toothache, so probably have to pull out a couple more. We'll see. I haven't seen my dentist yet.
Gene McKenzie with that report on Squid Game in South Korea. New series is coming out soon, apparently. Welcome back to NewsHour. For many migrants, Mexico is the last step in the journey many undertake, hoping to reach the US. In 2023, there were more than 2.4 million attempts to cross the border between the two countries, which the United Nations called the world's deadliest land migration route. Now, with Donald Trump elected as the next president of the United States, mass deportation of migrants looks likely. Mimi Swaby reports.
Scouring the Sonoran Desert every day, Lupita searches for migrants in distress. Combing through this harsh and arid terrain in her little Red Cross buggy, looking for people who are lost, dehydrated, or have been injured after trying to climb the wall that divides Mexico and the United States.
Here we see different situations, different problems. We see separated children, families, and people by themselves, both men and women. We've found migrants in transit and ones that have already been deported.
Lupita's daughter, Mariana, does the same work on the US side of the border. One task she's constantly working against is misinformation surrounding migrant routes, people's rights and the asylum process.
The majority of migrants we meet don't know a lot about legal information. Most of the time they ask us, and we give them some legal orientation and guidance. They don't know much about the laws, including their own rights.
But the mother and daughter's work goes much further than this.
A woman who was repatriated from the US had COVID. She looked really ill, so my mum took her to the hospital and the woman ended up in a coma for 6 months. The doctors didn't know she would survive and her family wasn't in Mexico. She came from El Salvador. All of this, my mum took charge of, offering her anything she needed medically and reuniting her with her family in El Salvador, so she could be with them again after so much time. Immigration was one of the key issues in the US election. Now, President-elect Donald Trump has promised to execute the largest domestic deportation in US history. He said he'll use the National Guard to round up migrants and also vowed to kick out hundreds of thousands of migrants who entered the US under the Biden administration.
Personally, we don't know about politics and the decisions he will make, but we want people who work in this field to ensure that migrants' rights are not violated. I would like to tell them that the rights of everyone should be respected, regardless of their nationality.
Lupita tells me they're prepared for more deportations.
What we do know is that we are prepared and will prepare even more to tackle these mass deportations so we can help anybody who is transiting through our town. I think this is the best thing we can do.
And that report from the BBC's Mimi Swaby there. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Now, I need to warn you that there is distressing content in this next report because it contains testimony from some of the victims of one of the most prolific online child abusers ever to be convicted. They've told the BBC they hope that by speaking out, more people will be encouraged to report sex crimes. They've spoken in a new BBC documentary series focusing on the prosecution of Alexander McCartney from Northern Ireland. He used a false identity on the internet. That's known as catfishing. And McCartney pretended to be a teenage girl to trick children into sending him explicit photographs of themselves. He then blackmailed them into carrying out acts of abuse. This report is from our island correspondent Chris Page, and it does begin with some of McCartney's victims.
I just felt dirty. Tore some of my innocence out.
If these pictures are blasted all over the internet, I don't want to live in that world. Like, that's terrifying.
I felt like it just wasn't going to end. I was curled up against my door in my room, crying.
Alexander McCartney was a relentless and remorseless abuser. Police think he targeted 3,500 children. Ivy was in New Zealand.
At 12, I was very much like a nerd. It was hard making friends. I just remember feeling weirded out but kind of flattered at the same time. A girl's interested in me. It was exciting. She sent images first.
She says that when she sent McCartney an explicit picture of herself, he turned on her.
I will send these to your friends and family. It's going to be everywhere. Unless you send me more. I was just confused and scared.
The victims who've taken part in the BBC documentary series called Teen Predator Online Killer have spoken out in the hope it'll help others. We're protecting their identities, so we aren't using their real names, but they have chosen to speak with their real voices.
I think doing this will help me a lot, to feel closure. Just feeling like I'm wrapping up, like, this chapter of my life.
Emily's from the US state of Oregon. McCartney used her image in his fake identity online.
He used my photos to catfish other girls, and it does make me angry. I did feel trapped, and I didn't feel like I could talk to anyone. I was kind of just asking myself, like, who's doing this? Is it someone I know? At the time, I was questioning if maybe it was people from my school doing this to me. as like a prank. It felt very real.
Would you state your name and date of birth for me?
Alexander McCartney, 2nd of 4th, 1998.
The series also shows McCartney's police interviews for the first time. Detectives question him about a message a victim received from the abuser, who called himself Chloe.
She says there was a message from Chloe. She said, "I'm a catfish." Do you know what that means?
Yeah, from the TV show Catfish.
What is it? Explain it to me.
No comment.
What's a catfish?
No comment.
Come on, Alex, you know what a catfish is.
No comment.
At the moment, we have 266 victims. There's 6 in Australia, 2 in Belgium, 12 in Canada, 1 in Colombia, Croatia, Denmark, Germany, Italy, Latvia, Lithuania, Mexico, Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Poland, Slovakia, Spain, Sweden, and 214 in the USA. Those figures are going to rise.
They did. Police say most of McCartney's victims were aged between 10 and 14. He ordered some to abuse other children. Detectives recount discovering more than 200,000 photos on one of McCartney's devices. They were what's termed first-generation pictures. In other words, they were of new victims.
I have never seen a folder structure such as this. It's vast.
The first download shows me the largest number of first-generation images to be captured on a device, certainly within the UK, potentially worldwide.
Contributors to the documentary hope more people will feel able to come forward to report crimes like McCartney's. Violet says she's glad she spoke to police.
People have lost their lives over this. I reported him and he got caught. Speak out, because you truly never know the magnitude of the situation you're dealing with.
And that report from our correspondent Chris Page in the BBC series is called Teen Predator Online Killer. Well, let's speak now to one of those who was involved in catching Alexander McCartney, and that's Special Agent Paul Wolpert. He's from Homeland Security in Virginia in the United States. Special Agent Wolpert, thank you very much for coming on to tell us more about this. I mean, it's clearly a very distressing story. How were you involved?
Yes, good afternoon. I became involved when one of the victims that we identified through this investigation reported it to our local law enforcement here in Virginia. And once we realized that the subject was in the UK, we reached out to try and figure out who that might be. And ultimately, we found out he had already been identified.
And so, I mean, the US and the UK do have very good relations, don't they, on things such as security and policing, that sort of thing. But, I mean, some of these countries, well, they're all over the world, aren't they? Did you have issues trying to coordinate the legal response in other countries?
I can say that when I found out if there was a victim located in another country, I forwarded the information to our offices over there in the UK, including the PSNI that we were working with, and then they took it from there. So I didn't directly have any involvement with the other countries outside of Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm. But most countries were keen to try to help if they could.
Oh, I believe so. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think when it comes to child exploitation, I kind of find it hard to believe any countries would not take that seriously.
Mm. I mean, this must be very difficult work for all the police officers involved, and the sort of material that you'd have to be dealing with. It can't be easy for the police officers involved.
This is probably the most serious type of crime that we investigate, because it does involve child victims. Sometimes it's children that are young enough or not old enough that they can speak for themselves. So, yes, it definitely is probably one of the hardest types of violations that we investigate.
And how do you deal with that?
Well, I've been doing it for 20 years. So, over time, you just move on and do the best you can and think about the good that you're doing. And in the meantime, you'll catch the violators. So, mm-hmm. I guess you can look at it as it's a win for us and especially the victims.
But I suppose the fact that this McCartney character was able to be so prolific worldwide, it does show the relative ease with which such abusers could work. And I suppose the fear is that there are others out there.
Yeah, there's absolutely somebody else out there. And that's our problem, is we don't monitor the internet. We can only act when somebody reports it. And in this case with sextortion or the catfishing, it's probably one of the biggest violations where somebody can reach the most amount of people in a short amount of time and victimize hundreds and in this case thousands of victims.
And what would you say to anyone who has been a victim but who's just too embarrassed to tell anyone or say anything or look for help?
Please report it. That's the only way we can do something. And go to a specialized person, not just a uniformed officer, because they're not really trained on how to deal with this. We have had people report and they just didn't get any results because the individual didn't know what to do. So look for a sex crimes investigator. But we absolutely need to hear it, because that's the only way we can do anything. Mm-hmm. And please don't delete anything. And, you know, I'd like to say you're not going to be in trouble. We need to let parents know that they can't let their kids feel like they're going to be in trouble if they report something like this, because we do find that a lot. They're afraid to report because they don't want to get their phones taken. They think they're going to be in trouble. And we just need to make sure that they aren't, mm-hmm. or at least they know that.
That's a really important message. Thank you very much for sharing that with us. That's Special Agent Paul Wolper there, Homeland Security, Virginia, USA. To another story of abuse now, sadly, I'm afraid, but it is making quite important headlines here in the UK and elsewhere around the world. And that's because the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, is coming under renewed pressure to resign his post. This is after a report revealed that he might have known some time ago about some of the behaviour of a man who turned out to be a prolific child abuser associated with the Anglican Church. This was John Smythe, who died before he could face punishment, but was found to have abused more than 100 young men and boys at Christian summer camps in Britain, in Zimbabwe, also in South Africa. The latest calls for the Archbishop of Canterbury to resign coming from the Bishop of Newcastle. Let's speak to the BBC's Harry Farley now, who's been on this story. Just tell us a little bit more on the case of John Smythe, what he did.
Yeah, well, John Smythe, after an interview with John Smythe, abused, as you said, dozens of boys initially in the UK in the 1970s and 80s at Christian camps. And crucially, Christian camps that the current Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, attended himself as a young man. And I'm outside Lambeth Palace in central London, the residence of the Archbishop of Canterbury. A report last week described the beatings that Smythe gave to teenage boys as prolific, brutal, and horrific. And now Smythe, as you said, died in 2018 before he could face justice. But the review, the church's review of the case, found that before he died, the Church of England knew at the highest level about the abuse, but its response, and I quote, was wholly ineffective and amounted to a cover-up. And Smythe went on to abuse other boys in Zimbabwe and South Africa right up until his death in 2018.
So this has been rumbling on for a few days, and the Archbishop of Canterbury has spoken about thinking about resigning and being open to it, but he said previously that he had been persuaded not to. Has anything changed in the past few days?
Nothing has changed since that interview last week. He apologised then. He said that the first that he was told of Smythe's abuse was in 2013, but he apologised for failing to make sure then that the allegations were, in his words, energetically investigated. And as you say, he said he considered resigning, was advised against it. Lambeth Palace said this morning that the Archbishop reiterates his horror at Smythe's abuse but does not intend to resign. And as you said in your introduction there, the first senior figure in the Church of England, the Bishop of Newcastle, joining those growing calls for him to quit.
All right. Well, thanks very much for updating us on the latest to that important story there. That's the BBC's Harry Farley joining us live. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. When Donald Trump decisively won the US election last week, world leaders queued up to congratulate him by phone in the hours and days afterwards. That's pretty standard. Usually there's a pecking order. The closer the ally, the sooner they get to speak to the new president-elect. But now there's confusion over whether Mr. Trump had a phone call with Russian President Vladimir Putin. It was reported by the Washington Post that a call between the two men took place on Thursday and that Mr. Trump had warned Mr. Putin not to escalate the conflict in Ukraine. Mr. Trump's team have refused to deny or confirm that, but now the Kremlin denies that it took place. I've been speaking to our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg. So did this call happen or not?
As far as the Kremlin is concerned, it didn't happen, and Vladimir Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, was pretty categorical in his denial. He said that the reports in the Washington Post do not correspond at all to reality. He said they were completely made up. He described them as false information. And he added that Vladimir Putin has no concrete plans to speak to Donald Trump right now about this. And when you consider that the Washington Post was quoting sources, allegedly people familiar with this alleged call, on the one hand, Dmitry Peskov is the only official who we've heard actually commenting on this and denying it actually happened. Interestingly, the Ukrainian president has been speaking quite positively of Donald Trump and hoping that he can actually be the man to bring peace to Ukraine. But I think if you look at the wider picture, there is a lot of concern in Kyiv right now that things are going to change and not for the better for Ukraine with Donald Trump in the White House. And if you look at what Mr. Trump was saying on the campaign trail, his complete lack of criticism of Vladimir Putin. He seemed to blame Joe Biden more than Vladimir Putin for Putin's invasion. And his criticism instead of the huge amount of military assistance and economic assistance that America has been providing Kyiv, that will have been noted certainly by Kyiv. And also, you know, if you remember back in September, J.D. Vance, now the vice president-elect, has sort of sketched out what a peace plan for Ukraine could look like. It sounded very much like the kind of things Vladimir Putin was talking about. In other words, Russia getting the right to keep the territory it had seized, some kind of demilitarized zone and neutrality for Ukraine. Ukraine would not be allowed to join NATO, in other words. All these things taken together are causing a lot of concern in Kyiv.
We also had a rather strange clip posted on social media yesterday by Donald Trump's own son, Donald Trump Jr., it was kind of a meme, wasn't it, showing President Zelensky saying, your allowance is about to run out. That seemed a bit odd coming from the son of a president.
Yeah, absolutely. Perhaps not that odd when you consider we're talking about Donald Trump here, the Trump family. But absolutely, that's another reason for concern for the administration in Kyiv. The fear is that once Trump is in the White House, then that could signal a severe reduction or the end of US military assistance for Ukraine. But something that Russians are saying, and you read a lot in the Russian press in recent days, emphasizing that Donald Trump is unpredictable. Yes, he has clearly avoided criticizing Vladimir Putin, and the signs are there that he may want to end this war, perhaps to the benefit of Russia. However, he is very unpredictable. One paper described him recently as an unguided missile who can fly off in any direction. So the Russians, they're hopeful that a Trump presidency will benefit them, but they're not convinced 100%.
And that was the BBC's Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. Now, the ancient Chinese city of Kaifeng apparently makes fantastic breakfast dumplings, prompting a group of hungry students from the nearby city of Zhengzhou to jump on their push bikes or rented bicycles, skateboards, even roller boots I saw in some pictures, in the middle of the night to make the journey to Kaifeng to get the first batch of the day. But when tens of thousands of students joined the midnight feast dash, it led to gridlock. Some fun of the bike bells there. Well, Kerry Allen is the BBC China analyst and joins us live now with the details. So what happened, Kerry, and how many are we talking about?
Well, this all started actually a while back in June when four women just decided on impulse to take off to Kaifeng from a nearby city called Zhengzhou. It's roughly about 50 kilometers to ride there. And they posted they left at 7 o'clock at night and they got there first thing in the morning. And it's encouraged other students to do the same. It's taken off on Chinese platforms like Xiaohongshu, which is the equivalent of Instagram in China, with people using the hashtag youth has no price, night ride to Kaifeng has it. And it's just taken off. It's, you know, lots of students thinking, you know, rather than going out clubbing or drinking, thinking, actually, I'm going to get on my bicycle and go on this bike ride.
Well, I mean, it does sound like a lot of fun, but I guess given the circumstances in China, we should ask about whether there could be more to this, because, of course, it is illegal, isn't it, to stage protests in China. Is there a chance that this was some kind of student protest disguised as a breakfast dumpling mass craving scenario?
I don't think so. It does appear to just be a bit of fun, but there definitely is nervousness when it's tens of thousands of students that are embarking on a big journey together, that they're, you know, it's a way of showing freedom, that the authorities do generally frown upon any mass gatherings because they know that they could spill over into protests. So they will have been closely watching this online and removing posts if they thought that anything might happen. So, yeah, there definitely would have been nervousness about this. But more than anything, it's being seen in China as just a way of young people taking back the night.
Well, I mean, I'm just looking at some of the pictures and we mentioned it was gridlock. It really does seem to have been. So I guess the traffic police at least would have had to be involved in that.
Oh, absolutely. And lots of the videos online have shown police officers basically, you know, keeping a close watch. And also the bike platforms themselves, these shareable bike platforms, have said that they don't agree with this. They're quite concerned that bikes are being carelessly left all over the place. And the authorities are quite nervous about mass attraction at these ancient sites.
Well, yeah, my last question, briefly, if you can. Kerry, what happened to the dumplings? Were there enough to go round?
Well, some sites have started staggering admission now for people to actually come in and eat dumplings or visit various attractions. And they are trying to discourage this.
And are they that good?
They're pretty good. China does love its food tourism. So, yeah, people are still intent to try them.
Oh, very good. All right. Well, thank you very much indeed. Kerry Allen there, the BBC China analyst, on the breakfast dumplings making news in China. Tens of thousands of students there making the midnight dash, cycling all that way, 50 kilometres she mentioned there. Well, that's it for this edition. Thank you very much for joining us.